I'm not.
Do you have your packets over there?
No, I'm just here to observe what's going on.
I'm gonna buy one of those jackets too, good. Also, I think it's appropriate to acknowledge because, you know, you can see the other things. We don't gouge. I mean, we didn't make any money on this breakfast. I'm sure you know that. Matter of fact, we lost money on the breakfast. And usually it comes out of, for all intents and purposes, Bill Bennett from my apartment. He's the secretary of the coalition. He's my law partner. And he suffers with me on the financial end of all this. And we're short. I mean, it's costing us like $300 over on our own pocket to finish this off. And my guy, Sloan Sue, who was responsible for us having a coalition sweep, with all that, he's donated $300 to the coalition to help make this breakfast come about. Please convey, I've already thanked him, but we'll give him a letter, but please thank him once again. And that's where everybody's doing their part and helping where it counts, and that counts. The next individual is going to be a recipient of the award, but frankly, I think he's got an important message that I wanted to give first, and then some honors need to be afforded. We all know no wimps here, but part of not being a wimp is also being articulate. Knowing how to use the written word, the sword and the quill, and one of the most effective writers in the entire coalition, he knows how to get action by communicating, is the Deputy Director of Communications for the coalition, and also the head of Homecoming 2, which we all know, and that's John Nevin. John, would you come forward?
Group of leaders that are represented right here in this room who are willing to fight the battle, to do what it takes, even when it is sometimes distasteful. I don't want to start with a list of names of people without which the coalition would not have nearly the impact. I want to talk to you for a moment, kind of as a PR man. You know, the Vietnam Veterans Coalition has made a massive impact in Washington within the past 18 months. They know who you are, and they know what you're doing. And we've got a lot of friends up there. But those who are not our friends know more carefully what we're doing and you're doing than do our friends. Now, the time at which the coalition identified the time at which we identified that as our number one priority was the time at which our impact started to be felt most significantly. And I think there's a very important reason that that's true. I want all of your groups to think about what it can do for you and your ability to influence other issues by identifying the POW issue as your top priority. Now, we have all seen organizations that have taken up a cause and have gained some media. We know how we react when we hear, "You owe me." Well, "you owe me" is certainly true in many cases, in many respects, certainly for those of you in this room. But "you owe me" does not sell. People don't want to hear it. But what people are willing to listen to and what they will react to is what they can perceive as a very unselfish effort to do something for somebody else. And therefore, no matter what you think, how you would list the POW issue on your priorities, your list of priorities, I would suggest to you that you identify it and press it as your top priority for that reason, if no other. The POW issue is not a family issue. It's not a veterans issue. It's an American issue.
There it is.
Yes.
Something more than the humanitarian side of the POW issue, although that alone would be enough. We would all very desperately like to get our men out of the horrible circumstance in which they find themselves today. But a lot of people feel that they recognize that people are suffering all over the world for a combination of reasons, children in Ethiopia, and people are starving and in terrible circumstance everywhere. But on the POW issue, there's a much bigger issue, several bigger issues. Not if, but when we bring these guys home, we are going to show the world that the American people have not lost their strength and their fiber and their commitment that the whole world once knew we had, but it seems to have disappeared. And a recognition, you know, every country in the world knows, every government in the world, people all over the world know that there are American servicemen still being held against their will in Southeast Asia. But in Washington, D.C., it is denied. And the existence of those men is a terrible blow to the credibility and to the perception of the American people throughout the world. But when we bring them home, we're going to turn that around. Another thing, absolutely, I don't want to lose my cool here.
That's all right, John.
You're authorized.
One time. We're my friend. Well, you know, this POW issue has become a morale problem in our active military. As we have done our job, letting people know that this problem exists, it's had some negative impacts. Because as more and more people become aware of the existence of this crisis, people sometimes have a tendency to throw up their hands and drop their eyes and say, there we go again. But I look at this issue very much like Watergate. I don't think that there's any question that Watergate in the short term had a very negative impact on our country in the short term. In the long run, though, I think it's had a very positive effect. It's brought to the attention of the American people some abuses of power that were allowed to occur. And it has, to some extent, made it more difficult for those abuses of power to occur again in the future. But they do still go on. And the POW issue can have exactly the same kind of impact as we identify those faceless, nameless bureaucrats that Colonel Hopper spoke about so eloquently. As we identify them and move them out of the way, we're going to strengthen this country from stem to stern. So this POW issue is not just for the men, although that would be reason enough. It is for our country. And we can never, never rest until we've succeeded. And I know you won't. We have an opportunity to turn the tables on now. Because of the abject failure of the Marxist-Leninist economic system that's been built on the Russian model in Southeast Asia, the economic condition in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos is the worst it has ever, ever been. And as we all know, revolutions grow out of adversity. They grow when people don't have the basic things that they need to survive. And unfortunately, in some respects, unfortunately for the people, but fortunately for the future, there is a growing animosity toward those communist governments. The animosity has always been there, but it's getting much broader support. And through these three distinguished gentlemen and the people that they represent, the United Indo-Chinese Resistance Movement, we're going to turn the table on them this time. We can win this battle by being more effective at showing the people of Indochina what is wrong with their government, and by creating that element of difficulty for those in power. And we're going to turn it around on them. These gentlemen represent exactly what is needed for Southeast Asia. And we fully support your efforts, gentlemen. We have not used a great deal of financial resources in doing our job. We have no paid staff. Our national office is donated by the law firm with which Bill and Tom are associated. We get an awful lot of bang for the buck because we've got a lot of dedicated people working out of their own pockets to push Vietnam veterans' issues forward. Now, we have been effective primarily because Tom and some others, but information in Washington. And in order to fight the enemy, you got to know who the enemy is and what they're doing. And you have to learn to think, predict what they're thinking so that you can react to what they're going to do before they even know they're going to do it. And we have, because of some of the things that we've been able to, some sources of information we've been able to develop in Washington, both inside the government and former members of the U.S. government, present and former military intelligence officers, several sources within the Indo-Chinese resistance, in fact, some sources close to some of the communists in Southeast Asia, some communist sources. We believe that we've got a much more accurate picture of what's happening and what should be happening in Southeast Asia than the American media, certainly, and maybe even than some elements of the U.S. government itself, because we have found through this POW issue that many times the very low-level bureaucrats are the ones who decide what information is actually passed to their superiors. Decisions are very often made in this country based on what some low-level individual decides to tell his boss about an intelligence report, a summary, the way a summary is written. There are several opportunities that are making themselves available in Southeast Asia. And we have not yet observed that there's a good faith effort on the part of the Reagan administration of the U.S. government to take advantage of those opportunities. And I need to stop for a minute and give you a brief disclaimer, as several other people have. I've been a Reagan supporter since 1964. Most of us think he's a good guy. Most of us support him generally in his politics. But when somebody's wrong, it's right in line with the what makes the coalition unique, that we're not afraid to say that they're wrong when they're wrong just because they are our friend on another issue. The most important reality of Southeast Asia, as it affects every American citizen, is the Soviet domination of Vietnam. Now, the Soviet grip on Vietnam that for a period of time became stronger and stronger is now weakening to some extent, because the Vietnamese people have no great love for their Soviet sponsors. As a matter of fact, there's a pretty substantial dislike of the Vietnamese people for the Russians. In fact, we've heard that their nickname for them is Americans Without Dollars. And I understand there are several nicknames using stronger language than that. You know, the Russian Navy, even before it was a communist country, has sought a warm water port in the Pacific for more than 150 years. Well, they've got one now, a major naval port facility, and we all know where it is and who built it for them, don't we?
Yes, sir.
I help.
Well, they've got major air bases also at Benoit, at Da Nang, and also at Kamran. Their presence there substantially threatens the security of many of the sea transport lanes from the Mideast to our East Asian allies, Japan, Taiwan. Their presence and the fruits that they are enjoying from their presence in Vietnam is a substantial threat to Pacific security. So a very substantial, significant, should be number one goal of U.S. Asian policy should be to do what we can to reduce the Russian influence in Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. Well, we've got some opportunities to do that now, some opportunities that we've never had before, because of the effort these gentlemen and their supporters, because of the growing support for what they are trying to do from within their countries, because of the Chinese dislike for the presence of Soviet troops along their southern border, and because of the terrible economic circumstance that particularly the Vietnamese are in. The Vietnamese communist government as desperately as they would like to boot the Soviets out. And I'm convinced that they would be thrilled to kick them out tomorrow. Although there are some elements within the Politburo who still strongly support the Soviets. Even with that assistance, Vietnam now has one of the lowest per capita incomes in the world. Part of that is because of the way they have so terribly drained their economy by putting so many of their resources in their military effort. While there is pretty substantial feeling, particularly among elements who have all along advocated closer ties to Beijing and Washington, it's pretty substantial feeling that continuing the military occupation of Cambodia is not in the best interest of Vietnam because of the economic drain that it causes. And I believe that there's an unusual opportunity to encourage the Vietnamese troops out of Cambodia. And I think if they have promised that they would be out by 1990, I think there's a great opportunity to get them out sooner. These issues are all inextricably intertwined. Even though the U.S. government and the Vietnamese government discuss them publicly at least and privately, we suspect, as if they were independent issues. You've all heard the statements that the POW issue is a humanitarian issue unconnected to any other concerns. Well, there's a barnyard phrase that describes my reaction to that. It's just not true. The POW issue, the Vietnamese occupation of Cambodia, the Soviet presence in Vietnam are all intertwined, and they can all be resolved and eliminated in very short order if this administration is willing to bite the bullet and face some of the political turmoil that will be created by a public realization that prisoners have been abandoned and that fact has been kept from the American people. I told you early on that I was going to talk as an outsider. Can't do a very good job of that. I guess I'm not as objective as I'd like to be. I would just like to say in closing, this issue is very complex for any individual American to understand, and no one is going to thoroughly understand it unless they really aggressively pursue the facts. But the facts are becoming more and more available to those who are willing to pursue. But the issue is not as terribly complex as it seems. It's really very simple. Do it in good faith, be willing to take the consequences, and do what's right. It can be done, but it's not being done. And it is up to us to supply the heat that will cause it to be done.
Yeah.
Service to Vietnam veterans. This gentleman is the first non-Vietnam veteran to receive this award. Yeah.
appreciation, I would be more appreciative of. Thank you.
Before going to other speakers and more awards, I told you I had some remarks, so I was more going to reserve later. I'd like to frankly give you the bottom line on the political strategy and what's kind of happening nationally. Because I know it's getting long in the day, getting tired, and I'm trying to keep this as tight as possible. Yes, we got a lot of help. We got people inside the White House. They're helping us. You wouldn't be incredulous if you knew some of the help we're getting. So I'm very sure of what I'm saying. The White House, the President, they all know that they're there. They've known for 5 years. The DIA has got all their names, maybe not all of them right today, but they got most of the names in specific locations. In the, not in my personal possession, but within the leadership of the coalition, we have most of the same information. The President, we put all these pressures on them. The strategy up to about January, when Gino Casanova did a summer strike, which we kind of manipulated into a telephone call of the President, and got the President on national meeting committee to meet with us on this POW issue, which resulted in the meeting to build in. What we thought at the time, it was so incredulous to us that the President would not act knowing that their information was there. We thought maybe he did not know as much as we thought he did. Maybe he didn't realize that some of this was a precedent. So before we went out and took some other action, that we ought to make sure, unequivocally, that he knew two things. One, that we were there and we had the evidence of it. And number two, that we knew he knew and we had the evidence of it. Two different ways to use it, same result, just in case. We were finally successful in getting Congressman Hinton into the President. And those two messages were conveyed. When I tell you, and one of the things we did because we worked, we armed Congressman with a very unique piece of information. The big secret, the little water gate that they were worried about. And the only thing is when Congressman Hinton left, he wouldn't like the thing. He said, hey, let's go get those guys out. What about this? He only gave one order. Find out the link, how they know that, or a piece of information. So that told us, they reviewed the option, reviewed the $4 billion to them. They rejected that, they reviewed the military operation, going to layoffs of special forces and SEAL teams. They concerned about even relying on the hostage crisis, so they turned that option down. And frankly, they also rejected the third option, which was to fund responsible private sector groups and resistance to get these guys out. Now, there are different philosophies of what could be done, but we all agree in the middle and they ought to be doing the third one, because that's a relatively low-risk option. They help our comrades in arms here, fits in with national strategy, very low risk. It rips up the underbelly of the commies while we're trying to negotiate with them. We can exploit those corruption difficulties. But they reject it all, and they're playing hardball with us. They are going to, they're not going to do anything. That's the bottom line, unless we overwhelm them. Now, there's some people who have not been here today that some of you have seen before. General Colonel Barry is here. General Smith, Jimmy Smith and McIntyre are here. They're not here today. There's a reason for it. They're doing something about it. Two ways to do this, and we have not been able to spark the media yet. We're trying a new thing. There's something going to develop in 30 days. It'll be a national thing. The coalition made it happen. We're going to put a lot of heat on the President. Right kind of way. We got some information a little bit about this whole thing that he's not going to like coming out. But we think the only way to really spark the media and put the pressure on the government is bring a guy out. So the guys that John Brown, you're here, you work on that kind of stuff. And with the